Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 278, titled Connecting the Dots, Part 2. As indicated by the title, this broadcast is going to be drawing connections between a number of different elements, and I would note that for the diligent and regular listener, virtually all of this broadcast will be by way of review. However, due to the intensive nature of the program and the dizzying array of connections between many of these elements, not necessarily juxtaposed before, I thought it would be important and for many listeners perhaps necessary to take the time to illustrate many of the connecting elements between many of the admittedly strange, nonetheless vitally important pieces of information that I present on this broadcast. Now, we're going to begin by excerpting a piece of program number 245. This is titled, Deutsche Telekom über alles, and this talks about the links between the lobbying firm that is lobbying on behalf of Deutsche Telekom's purchases in the United States, the treasurer of the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU party of Germany, and a number of other different things that we're going to be talking about, including some of the politics of Holocaust and Third Reich related lawsuits. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 245. It's also worth taking a noting here what law firm is being selected by Deutsche Telekom to lobby its position in Washington. This is from the Wall Street Journal of Friday, July 21st of the year 2000. This is an article by Wall Street Journal staff reporters William Boston in Bonn and Jill Carroll in Washington. It's headlined, Deutsche Telekom Lobbies But Mildly in Washington. And skipping down, only recently did the company hire a law firm with the swagger to open doors in D.C., signing up Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering to represent it. Skipping down, Mr. Zomer has said of this, the purchase of VoiceStream, we are not coming as invaders, he said in a telephone interview yesterday. I would say that is open to debate. And skipping down again, Democratic Senator Ernest F. Hollings of South Carolina is urging the Federal Communications Commission to block any acquisition by Deutsche Telekom, which he calls, quote, a monopoly owned by the German government that operates from a protected home market, unquote. And skipping down again, if Deutsche Telekom is biding its time, the same can't be said for the German government. Alerted by a stern warning letter from the German ambassador in Washington last week, senior German foreign ministry and economics ministry officials have had talks about the Hollings letter and Deutsche Telekom with their counterparts at the State Department and the FCC, according to Berlin officials. Now, note again that the law firm of Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering has been signed to handle the lobbying for Deutsche Telekom's position in Washington. We spoke about Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering in For the Record program number 139, and Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering in turn had signed a German government minister as a partner, and Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering has been involved in some very interesting activities indeed. That former German transport minister is named Matthias Wissmann, and we're going to excerpt For the Record program number 139 in order to hear more not only about Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering and its signing on a former German cabinet minister as a partner, but also some of the previous cases that Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering has handled on behalf of German industry. This again is excerpted from For the Record program number 139. Again, this from the Financial Times of London of 3/2/1999. This is an article headlined, Wissmann Joins Washington Firm. Matthias Wissmann, W-I-S-S-M-A-N-N, the treasurer of Germany's CDU opposition party and a former transport minister, has become a partner of the Washington law firm of Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, in one of the most dramatic attempts yet by U.S. lawyers to export their regulatory expertise to Europe. The firm is best known in Europe for its role in representing the Swiss banks when they were sued in the U.S. over their alleged confiscation of assets belonging to Holocaust survivors. It is now working for several German companies being sued over their use of slave labor during the Second World War. By the way, the CDU party is the party that was in power for some 16 years. Helmut Kohl is a member of the CDU-CSU coalition. And so please note this is a very, very significant figure for Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering to be taking on. And again, he's a former transport minister of Germany. And note that this company is now working for several German, this law firm, I should say, is now working for several German companies being sued over their use of slave labor during the Second World War. Skipping down, senior lawyers at Wilmer Cutler make it clear they believe Europe could be a big market for them, pointing to the lead that Brussels is already taking in privacy issues and to the difficulty some U.S. mergers have had in gaining EU clearance. That again is excerpted from For the Record program number 139 from the early spring of 1999. So note again the role of Matthias Wissmann as a partner with Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, and the fact that that firm had handled lawsuits against Swiss banks for confiscating assets of Holocaust victims. Many of those Swiss banks tied in with the Bormann Group, as we've looked at in numerous broadcasts. They also are handling the slave labor lawsuits for several major German corporations. That, again, excerpted from For the Record program number 245, and in turn, that contained an excerpt from For the Record program number 139. Now, in broadcasts number 275 and 276, I dealt with a lawsuit that's been filed against IBM, and in turn with a book published by, and this is one of the major connections, Bertelsmann, again, a German-controlled firm, the third-largest media conglomerate in the world, and a major focal point of the broadcast dealing with German corporate control over the American media. And note that with mobile telephones rapidly emerging as a major vehicle for accessing the Internet, the aforementioned 245, For the Record 245, was part of that series. And note that Matthias Wissmann, the treasurer for the CDU, is a member of Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, lobbying on behalf of Deutsche Telekom to open up the American telecommunications market to Deutsche Telekom, controlled by the German government, okay? And note also that Wilmer Cutler and Pickering is handling lawsuits for Swiss banks, Holocaust-related lawsuits for Swiss banks, and also lawsuits on behalf of slave laborers who had been utilized by the Third Reich. Now, take note of something that we noted in For the Record program number 276 at the end. This is from the Financial Times of London of Thursday, February 15th of the year 2001. Now note that the book, IBM and the Holocaust by Edwin Black, a remarkable book, by the way, and one that's the focal point of For the Record program number 279 that listeners to this program will hear probably next week. Note that Crown Publishers that published IBM and the Holocaust is owned by Random House, which is owned by Bertelsmann. Now, at the same time as a German publisher, Piper Verlag, was publishing a book in Germany called The Holocaust Industry, maintaining that the Holocaust had been appropriated, quote, by an American Jewish elite, unquote, and had flat out become an extortion racket, unquote, not only discrediting the Holocaust, but also basically charging those who were interested in achieving legal adjudication for the Holocaust with being cynics and mercenaries. Note that at the same time as that book was being published in Germany, with all major German corporations being controlled by the Bormann Group, about which I've spoken so often, and about which we will be speaking again this evening, please note that at the same time, Bertelsmann, which would appear to be a Bormann company, is publishing the book, which in turn has been coordinated with this particular lawsuit. Now again, bearing in mind the role of Wilmer Cutler and Pickering in lobbying on behalf of Deutsche Telekom, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering employing the treasurer of the CDU, and Wilmer Cutler and Pickering handling these lawsuits for German corporations and Swiss banks related to German corporations, consider the following. This is from the Financial Times of Thursday, February 15th of the year 2001. This article is by Richard Wolff, Wolffe, and John Authors, Authers, headlined, IBM Legal Bombshell Threatens Landmark Holocaust Deal. And as you listen to the potential implications of the new lawsuit against IBM, bear in mind that as we saw in For the Record 275, public relations is deemed to be a very important element in many of these lawsuits, obliging out-of-court settlements. Bear in mind the Bertelsmann publication of IBM and the Holocaust that I alluded to earlier. This article reads in part, skipping down, after this week's filing of a new lawsuit against IBM alleging complicity in the Holocaust, the landmark deal is now threatened with a critical loss of public confidence. That's the settlement about some of the slave and slave labor and forced labor lawsuits in Germany. Skipping down, several people on the German side of the negotiations believe that the new suit against IBM breaches this requirement, that is the requirement of legal peace, opening the possibility that they will refuse to pay. The paragraph before that clarifies that. Under last year's agreement, which set up a special foundation to receive the money and pay victims, German companies will not part with any funds until they have been assured of legal peace in the U.S., skipping down. Other law firms involved in the German settlement were apparently not contacted by Mr. Hossfeld about the IBM lawsuit, which took most of them by surprise. Many of them appeared angered by Mr. Hossfeld's decision, which they believed could delay payments to victims or even destroy the German settlements altogether. So note that the new IBM lawsuit, coordinated with the publication by Bertelsmann of a book about IBM and the Holocaust, and this is again not to be misinterpreted as being cynical about the profound role, the incomparably important role played by German American finance and industry in the Third Reich, a subject I've covered in many broadcasts, but rather to ask that with this information having to a large extent been public for a long time, why is it that some of these lawsuits and some of these publications are being handled in the way that they are being handled? In particular, the publication of the Edwin Black book, IBM and the Holocaust, a remarkable book, and this is not to be cynical about Mr. Black or the book itself, it's the focal point of For the Record 279, but it has received a great deal of publicity. Note the following, too, in connection with this IBM lawsuit and the attendant Bertelsmann publication of the Edwin Black book. This is from the Financial Times of Wednesday, February 28 of the year 2001. This is by John Reed, and it's headlined, Polish Victims of Nazis Angered by Delay in Paying Compensation. And of the role of the IBM lawsuit, once again we read, skipping down, the expected payments have been slowed by legal issues in the U.S., with German companies unwilling to begin payouts until they are guaranteed, quote, legal peace, unquote, from future Holocaust-related lawsuits. And as we noted in that previous Financial Times article, the IBM lawsuit threatens that, quote, legal peace, unquote. One wonders about Bertelsmann's role in publishing the book, which is deemed to be very important from a public relations standpoint, as a component of that lawsuit. So Bertelsmann, the lawsuits on behalf of slave laborers in Germany, and Wilmer Cutler and Pickering's role in the Deutsche Telekom lobbying process, that's one of the series of dots to be connected. Now bear in mind that Matthias Wismann is the treasurer of the CDU. The most recent CDU chancellor in Germany was Helmut Kohl, whose chief of staff, Günter Strassmayer, was involved with effecting the reunification of Germany. His son Andreas, the mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing, Timothy McVeigh being his protege. We're now going to consider the role of the CDU funding scandal, which was the focal point of For the Record programs 193 and 276. We're going to reprise a few articles from number 276. First of all, from the Financial Times of London of February 3rd and February 4th of the year 2001. This concerns Alfred Servin, who has just been extradited from the Philippines. This particular article is about the ELF Aquitaine affair. The ELF Aquitaine was the former name for a subsidiary of the French oil giant, which functioned as a de facto government oil monopoly. And one of the central elements in the CDU funding scandal concerned a payment from ELF Aquitaine and the Mitterrand government in France to the CDU in order to secure ELF Aquitaine's acquisition of the Leuna refinery in the former East Germany. That's spelled L-E-U-N-A. And by the way, in an upcoming segment that you're going to listen to, you will hear me mispronounce that. I pronounced it Leuna. It's pronounced Leuna. This article from the Financial Times of 2-3 and 2-4 of 2001 is by Bertrand Benoit, or Benoit, B-E-N-O-I-T. It's headlined, Light Shed on an Extraordinary Past. And the discussion of ELF Aquitaine is as follows. Founded in 1967, ELF was born from a merger of various oil prospecting bureaus set up by the French government in the 1930s, with a view to securing independent energy resources for the country. So note that it was formed in the 1930s. Skipping down, Mr. Lefloche's tenure with Mr. Servin as his second-in-command also coincided with the signature of the very deals that would capture the attention of the French Justice Department. These included the expensive acquisition of the East German refinery of Leuna in 1992, thought to be linked to the illegal funding of German political parties. So note that the acquisition by ELF Aquitaine and the resulting bribe, apparently, paid through to the CDU, was instrumental in effecting the acquisition, again, of the Leuna refinery for ELF Aquitaine. And skipping down of the ultimate fate of ELF Aquitaine, we read, and this will be for a reference that I will be bringing forward in a minute, the company barely outlived its controversial chairman. Engulfed in a ballooning scandal, it succumbed to a hostile bid from rival Totalfina in 1999. The company is now called Totalfina ELF, so note that for future reference. Now, one of the questions that I have concerns the possible role of the CDU funding scandal, and bear in mind that the treasurer of the CDU, Matthias Wismann, is a partner with Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, with all of the connections from the Deutsche Telekom lobbying to the Holocaust-related lawsuits that I just spoke about. Bear in mind that the treasurer of the CDU was Matthias Wismann. Now, I wonder about the role of the CDU funding scandal in perhaps exerting pressure on the French political, economic, and financial infrastructure in order to basically motivate them in a pro-German direction. More about that in a minute. I would note that Mr. Savin, on his way back to France, stopped over in Germany, and although he was expected to be immediately turned over to the French authorities, there was about a 24-hour delay, and although I'm not going to talk about that in detail now due to the limitations of time, that delay caused a lot of anxiety in France. Once again, from the Financial Times of February 3rd and February 4th of the year 2001, article by Raphael Minder, David Owen, and Hugh Williamson. This is headlined, Star Witness in French Corruption Trial Arrested. And of the arrest of Mr. Sylvain, we read, skipping down, Alfred Sylvain, a 74-year-old former executive of ELF Aquitaine, the once state-owned French oil company, was due to land in Frankfurt at 5:45 a.m. He was immediately expected to be transferred to Paris by a French government aircraft. And I would note that his stopping off in Frankfurt created a great deal of anxiety. Turning to yet another article from that very same issue of the Financial Times of London, February 3rd and February 4th of 2001, yet another article, a sidebar article about Mr. Savin, is by Raphael Minder, M-I-N-D-E-R, in Paris, headlined, Savin Set to Unpack Explosive Evidence. And this article reads in part, Before Alfred Savin set off on what turned out to be a four-year flight from French justice, he warned that he knew enough secrets to, quote, make the Republic blow up 20 times, unquote. France may soon find out what he had in mind. Bearing in mind ELF Aquitaine and its role in the acquisition of the Leuna refinery in Germany, consider the following. We're going to turn now to the landmark text, the definitive text about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground. If that seems crazy to new listeners, bear in mind that there is ample documentation and this remarkable book contains it, and I've spoken about it at great length in many broadcasts that are available from Spitfire. Of the cannibalization of the French economy by the Third Reich as it occupied France during World War II, and of the collaboration between the French elite, French businessmen, industrialists, and bankers, and their German counterparts, anti-communism and anti-socialism being the common bond. By the way, this discussed in the miscellaneous archive show entitled Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce, of the connections between the French elite and their German counterparts and the cannibalization and subjugation and subsuming of the French economy into that of Germany during the occupation of World War II, we read in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning. By the way, the hardcover edition, copyright 1981, published by Lyle Stewart. And again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, reads in part as follows about the French-German industrial connection. In the years before the war, the German businessmen, industrialists, and bankers had established close ties with their counterparts in France. After the Blitzkrieg and invasion, the same Frenchmen in many cases went on working with their German peers. They didn't have much choice, to be sure, and the occupation being instituted, very few in the high echelons of commerce and finance failed to collaborate. The Third Republic's business elite was virtually unchanged after 1940, skipping down. They regarded the war and Hitler as an unfortunate diversion from their chief mission of preventing a communist revolution in France. Anti-Bolshevism was a common denominator linking these Frenchmen to Germans, and it accounted for a volunteer French division on the Eastern Front, skipping down again. The upper-class men who had been superbly trained in finance and administration at one of the two Grand Corps schools were referred to as France's permanent wall of money, unquote, and as professionals they came into their own in 1940. They agreed to the establishment of German subsidiary firms in France and permitted a general buy-in to French companies. In 1940, French banks sold a large part of their holdings in the industrial and banking enterprises of Central and Southeastern Europe. After all, they reasoned, the German armies were already there, and they secured French interests, and half a loaf is better than none. And still more about the relationship between the French economy and that of Germany, and the perpetuation of this into the post-war period, we read, again, from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, society's natural survivors, French version, who had served the Third Reich as an extension of German industry, would continue to do so in the period of post-war trials, just as they had survived the war, occupation, and liberation. These were many of the French elite, the well-born, the propertied, the titled, the experts, industrialists, businessmen, bureaucrats, and bankers, skipping down. Economic collaboration in France with the Germans had been so widespread on all levels of society that there had to be a realization that an entire nation could not be brought to trial. Only a few years before, there had been many a sincere and well-meaning Frenchman, as in Belgium, England, and throughout Europe, who believed National Socialism to be the wave of the future, indeed the only hope for curing the many desperate social, political, and economic ills of the time, and of the perpetuation of the subsumed and collaborationist French economy into the Bormann Group and its implications for post-war France, we read as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The characteristic secrecy surrounding the actions of German industrialists and bankers during the final 9 months of the war, when Bormann's flight capital program held their complete attention, was also carried over into the post-war years when they began pulling back the skeins of economic wealth and power that stretched out to neutral nations of the world and to formerly occupied lands. There was a suggestion of this in France. Flora Lewis, writing from Paris in the New York Times of August 28, 1972, told of her conversation with a French publisher, quote, "It would not be possible to trace ownership of corporations and the power structure as in the United States. Quote, they, unquote, would not permit it. Quote, they, unquote, would find a way to hound and torture anyone who tried," commented the publisher. They seem to be a fairly small group of people who knew each other, but many are not at all known to the public. They move in and out of government jobs, but public service apparently serves to win private promotion rather than the other way around. The government control that practically everyone mentions cannot be traced to stock holdings, regulatory agencies, or public decisions. It seems to function through a maze of personal contacts and tacit understandings," unquote. Manning goes on to comment, "The understandings arrived at in the power structure of France reach back to pre-war days and were continued during the occupation. They have carried over to the present time." Flora Lewis, in her report from Paris, commented further, quote, "This hidden control of government and corporations has produced a general unease in Paris." And one of the questions that I have is whether perhaps, and I suspect this is very much the case, whether Mr. Servin's explosive evidence that he said could, quote, bring down the French Republic 20 times over, I wonder if that has to do with the very sub rosa, Bormann-connected industrial and financial structure of France. I think it's a pretty good bet. Now, one of the things that I question, one of the major questions, one of the connections of the sequence of dots here that I'm discussing in this program, concerns the surfacing of Mr. Servin and his extradition at this time. He'd managed to go to ground for a period of years, but his apprehension and his extradition to France came at a crucial time. And we're going to reprise an article that I've looked at in a couple of different programs, For the Record program number 274, and again briefly at the end of number 276. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who researched this for us from The Scotsman of January 26th of the year 2001. This comes from The Scotsman's website at thescotsman.co.uk/world. This is an article by Alan Hall in Berlin, dateline Tuesday, January 23rd. It's headline, Schroeder Launches Brussels Offensive, and it reads in part as follows. Germany, plowing ahead with plans to strip EU members of sovereign decision-making, will throw its weight behind federalist plans at the Strasbourg summit with France in a week's time. And skipping down still further, Joschka Fischer at a weekend think tank in Berlin outlined his vision for a Europe where decisions on tax, defense, health, insurance, and a plethora of other issues were defined by the EU and not national governments. One German newspaper said his comments would, quote, send a shudder through London and Paris, unquote. Those shudders will be addressed tomorrow when Mr. Fischer meets Robin Cook in London, particularly as Mr. Fischer will try to sell Britain a timetable for agreeing to a common European constitution to be agreed upon at another conference in 2004. The weekend think tank in Berlin was hosted by the Bertelsmann Foundation. That's the parent company of Bertelsmann. And skipping down, there was little pleasure across the Rhine at Schroeder's comments or of those of Mr. Fischer, who also spoke stridently of German efforts to build a federalist utopia that has long been at the heart of his political philosophy. Quote, the German government will not stand idly by, but would take courageous steps against the centrifugal forces of the intergovernmentalists. Unquote. And this refers to the failure of the Nice Conference at which Germany tried to prevail on France for a so-called vote reweighting. And so I wonder whether perhaps the surfacing of Mr. Servin has to do with the pressure by Germany to create a federalist Europe dominated by Germany. This is something that both Britain and France have resisted. And I wonder whether perhaps the post-war economic marriage, the marriage of the economic structure of France to that of Germany and the Bormann Group, and the potential revelations that the CDU funding scandal, the ELF Aquitaine acquisition of the Leuna refinery could have. I wonder if that is one of the reasons Mr. Servin surfaced at this particular time. We're going to continue this discussion on the other side of the tape. However, we are almost at the end of this half hour. I've alluded to other tapes that are available. They're available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179. That's Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There's a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 278 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. The For the Record segments are now being archived on Real Audio by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. You can access these Real Audio files at their website at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 278, Connecting the Dots, Part 2. This is being recorded on March 4th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.